session number 24610, Rule 3.
Mr. Guest, Rule 3. We're talking about your time at Lenin Camp outside Bury St Edmunds. And I wondered how you got on and what you thought of your instructors, you know, your NCOs who were doing the bulk of the training with you.
Well, obviously they were there to be strict and teach us to be soldiers. And at the time, we obviously felt that they were a little bit hard and full of bullshit and one thing and another. But I suppose in retrospect, they'd got a job to do, and they were trying to make us into a fighting unit, should I say. And I think they succeeded. They taught us how to drill, how to march in a straight line, and how to halt as one man and not clatter together like a machine gun, you know.
Did they do a lot of shouting? Yeah,
a lot of shouting, and some of it was... some of it was a bit crude, you know, and I felt a little bit, what should I say, childish, you know, when if you don't sort yourself out, I'll break your arm and bang you, hit you with a soggy end and all that sort, which to me was absolutely stupid, you know. But
did they swear?
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I've been brought up in the building, on the building, so, I mean, I knew what it was to be sworn at and to swear and one thing or another, and unfortunately, in the army especially, swearing becomes part of life. I suppose it's expressing yourself and you haven't got the... you're expressing yourself out of ignorance, really, because you haven't got the, shall I say, the vocabulary to really... stop the swearing, you know. It just becomes an emphasis on what you've got to say at the time.
Was there more of it than there had been in the building site, or was it much the same? And had the words changed?
Shall I say? I don't think there was more, because I started in the building trade straight after the war, so there were soldiers that I was working with, and there. Their vocabulary obviously included a hell of a lot of swearing, but it was gentle swearing. It wasn't forced upon you like it was by the NCOs. I mean, they would call you a bloody nignog, you know, and a no good bastard, and always that and the other, you know, and you'll never make a so and so soldier, and this, you know, this it was really to. I suppose really it was to instill in you that orders will be obeyed at all times without question. And you didn't realise it at the time, but I mean this is something that went right through your army life and was included in the time when we were up the sharp end. You know,
you don't
forget your training, like, you know, and that's you know, in retrospect, that was the reason, I would say, for that, you know, that you had to obey orders, and this was part of the army way of thinking.
Did you see much of the officers while you were training, as a basic training?
Not a great deal. We had a platoon officer. In the main, we were trained by platoon sergeant, but mostly by two platoon corporals, who did the everyday running of the platoon or unit, and then the sergeant would come out every couple of days or so and supervise kit inspections and that sort of thing, and when there's anything going on, a bit of a flap, then the sergeant would lead the parade and tell everybody what a good bloke he was, but it was his corporals that had actually done the hard work, you know. And then the officer, of course, used to come out on sort of special parades. He didn't really take a lot of, he didn't play a very big part in your actual training, not the platoon officer.
Now, you were doing your sort of basic training from April 51 to start of June 51. Is that, would that be right?
Yeah.
Were you tested at the end? You've got these tests of elementary training.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I've got those.
No point, because I can't, you know. But what were you sort of assessed, and was there a passing out and the rest
of
it?
Oh, yes, there was an assessment. You were tested on the rifle. Tests of elementary training on the rifle and the Bren gun, and obviously given marks for it, a pass at the end of the, well, if you were lucky, you got a pass mark at the end of your training.
Was there a special parade at the end, or
yes, we did have a passing out parade. It was, you know, compared with today, it's very low key. We just paraded past the CO, and he took the salute, and then we rushed back to the billets and got ready to go home on leave, you know.
Now, what was your next posting, or, you know, your next part of your training, really?
Well, the next part of the training, we finished after 6 weeks. That was a basic training, and then we did continuation training, and that took place in Bury again, but that was 10 weeks continuation training.
At the same place?
At the same place. Blenheim Camp, yeah.
And what was the continuation training?
Well, the honing up of our skills learned in the first 6 weeks. We'd also been assigned to regiments. Now, at the time, as I said, you know, there were the Bedford Hearts, the Suffolks, the Norfolks, the Essex, and the Northamptonshire. And as I see it, that was the five regiments that all joined together and made the East Anglian Regiment.
And who were you posted to?
I was posted to the Royal Norfolks. At the end of our 6 weeks training, I think it was at the end of the 6 weeks training, or it might have been the beginning of the continuation training, we were given an option to make a choice of the regiment that we'd like to be in. Now, my father was in the Beds and Hearts, and he fought in Gallipoli with the Anzacs. And my brother was also in the Beds and Hearts, and he served the war, and he went to France, Belgium, and Holland in just after D-Day. And my grandfather, he was also an old Bedfordshire man when it was the Bedfordshire Regiment, and so obviously my choice was the Beds and Hearts. But the army, in their perverse way, decided that as I was combatant age. There was two fields of combat at the time, Malaya and Korea. I didn't want to go to Malaya, really. And anyway, they decided that I would go in Norfolk, and I went to Korea.
And they decided that at the start of your continuation training?
Yeah, yeah.
So all the time you were doing the continuation training, you knew you'd be going to Korea? Now... what about your country? So, were you trained by Royal Norfolk instructors then?
No. Just a motley bunch of sergeants and corporals in any of those five regiments. What they call, you know, for permanent staff on the actual Blenheim camp.
And what do you remember about the continuation training, or is it just more of the same?
More of the same, but a little bit more severe. We did a lot more forced marches. We were doing sort of a couple of days a week. We were doing 15 miles a day, and it was speed marching. And I think they'd got some old boots actually to get rid of. They got some boots FP, finish pattern. Because they thought they'd be fighting in Finland, and these boots have been mouldering away in some dungeon somewhere, and they bought them out and issued them to us. And of course, I've only got little feet; I've got size sixes, and I did my marching in size eights, I think they were. So I wear two or three pairs of socks to fill my boots out, you know. And we used to do, say, we used to do small pack and march 15 miles a couple of times a week, perhaps more. And quite a funny incident to do with this FP boots. They were absolutely festooned with umbrella hobnails underneath. And I'd got a boil on my arm. And it was a pretty nasty one. I was really sore, and I showed it to a corporal, and he said, "Oh, so I think you better go special sick, because I've got this big lump under my arm, you know, and all this, that, and the other." Anyway, went special sick, and of course you had to march in up to the MO, come to attention at his desk, and then he'd ask you what was wrong. And anyway, I marched into the MO's office. And they'd got this, what they call a lamer asphalt floor. It's just like ordinary asphalt you have on roof, and it's polished, and it was brown, and it was a new, fairly new thing. Anyway, I come marching up to the desk, and I put my left foot forward and brought my right one up, and I fell flat on my back, bang, and my boots finished up at his shoes, you know, underneath the desk. And he looked over the top, he said, "Are you all right, lad?" I showed him my boil, and I got a couple of shots of penicillin in my bum, and it cleared up. But I was a bit worried at the time, because I wanted to stay with my mates, and I thought it might defer my posting, but no, it didn't.
Anything else about the training? I mean, what other weapons did you... I mean, did you get introduced to more weapons?
Yeah, I think we got introduced to the Sten gun, but... They were an infantry weapon, but I think I got introduced to the Sten gun more when I went to Hong Kong, and the training got we were with a regiment that had already been to Korea and knew what the crack was, as they say.
So it was just an introduction to the Sten gun.
Yeah, an introduction to the Sten.
Any other weapons?
No, I don't think so. I fired a 3.5 rocket launcher at one time, but I can't remember whether that was in the continuation training or when I think it was when I went to Hong Kong. We went to a place called Low Wu Ranges.
This 10 weeks doesn't seem to be much about that. It doesn't seem to stick in your mind. Really.
Not continuation. No. It was a lot of forced marching. There was obviously quite a bit of firing on the ranges. And generally sharpening up the skills that we'd learned in the first 6 weeks, and toughening up with the assault courses and that sort of thing.
And this would be till about September?
Yeah. I think it was towards the end of August, actually, and then we were drafted to Hong Kong.
Now, what do you remember of the drafting to Hong Kong, the organisation of it?
Oh, the organisation was pretty good. We finished our 10 weeks training. We got 7 days embarkation leave, and then we got on the train in Bury St Edmunds. And after a long, long day, we finished up at Liverpool and got on a boat called the Empire, or a troop ship called the Empire Pride. That was about 11,000 tons, I think that was.
And that was still in August, or just tipped into September?
The end of August, because I think we landed in Hong Kong about the 21st of September, and it was a 4-week trip, so yeah, it'd be sort of the last week in August, I suppose.
Now, what were conditions like on the boat? Where was you met? What mess deck were you on, and what was the conditions like?
Oh, we were about one deck lower than the ship's cat, I believe. I would say we were well down. We were just about on the waterline, and we were in hammocks. There was no bunks as such. Life was very relaxed, really. There's not a lot to do on a troop ship. It was a 4-week journey.
Was it very cramped down there?
Very cramped. Yeah. We all slung hammocks, and you know, while you were slinging your hammocks, it was really difficult to get, you know, to get your bed space in, really. And of course, parties of you used to go on fire duty in your mess deck, and also there would be a rota on your table. I suppose there'd be about 18, 20 men onto a mess deck table, and you would take it in turns to go and collect the food from the galley. Food wasn't bad. It wasn't a great deal of it. It was sufficient, I suppose. But as we were not, shall we say, shopping in the high street, there was a small shop on the ship, and we used to spend our money, you know, on chocolates and sweets and biscuits and that sort of thing. Cigarettes, we used to get 50 a week free issue, as we were going to, in inverted commas, on active service.
What about seasickness? A bit of a problem or not?
No, it was no problem to me at all. I've never been affected by seasickness at all. But there was a lad from Rushden named Jim Taylor, who incidentally was a bricklayer. He apprenticed bricklayer. And the only time that he wasn't sick and we were afloat was when we were actually going down the Suez Canal. But as soon as we hit the Red Sea, he was up and over the side, you know. And by the time we got to Hong Kong, that lad was green. He was an awful colour. He was completely dehydrated and quite a sick man.
I presume most of them didn't have that. I mean,
no, there were very few of them that had. I mean, he's the only case that I can recall that was really bad. Ivan Holland, my mate, he had a bad spell for a couple of days when we were in a particularly rough bit of sea. I can't think where it was. It certainly wasn't the Bay of Biscay, because we went through the Bay of Biscay in a fog, and the sea was as calm as a mill pond.
You were going out as a draft, were you?
As a draft, yes.
What size was a draft?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose about 180 men, I suppose.
Now, did much happen on the way out? As you say, there's not much happened.
No, not much happened. I mean, we did a little bit of drilling on the decks. Not very much, because the space was limited. We spent most of the time loafing around, really. There was a couple of times when we had a shoot over the stern of the ship, threw some beer cans in the sea and fired at them and that sort of thing. But in the main, it was pretty low key. We did have some games of, well, not bingo really. They call it tombola in the Army and the Navy, apparently. You know where you, I think it was threepence a ticket, and you call out the number. You know, typical bingo sort of thing. I was never fortunate enough to win. But we stopped in Aden.
Did you get ashore?
Yeah. Went ashore in Port Said.
These first visits ashore. What were your first impressive place at Port Said?
Port Said, all very different. I mean, it was a different world. I mean, it was a complete culture change, really, you know. I mean, we'd never seen an Arab before, sort of thing. But yeah, Port Said, and then Aden. Aden was was a bit of a no starter, really, because we landed in Steamer Point Aden, and the real town was about 5 miles away. Well, one or two of the lads who were more adventurous did walk to town, and as soon as they got there, they'd got to walk back, because we were back on board ship at sort of 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening. Then from where do we go from Aden? Colombo. And got ashore there. Where a very charming lady tried to spit betel nut juice down our jungle greens.
What was that?
I don't know. She just got the hump, and as we came past in that jungle green, she, you know, spat a gobful of this beetle juice at us. And then Singapore, we had a day in Singapore. They were all days. And then from Singapore, we went up to Hong Kong. And we were met by a military band who played us off the boat, and then we were on trucks and went up to up country.
Now, whereabouts did you go? What unit
did you attach to? We were in a camp called Sanwai Camp.
Sanwai.
Sanwai. Sanwai. Sanwai Camp, and it was.
Whereabouts is that?
Up in the New Territories, yeah, about 30 miles up, I suppose. No, actually, I don't think we did a go on trucks. I think we went on the train.
And what were your first impressions of Hong Kong?
Well, it was a bit bewildering to start with, really. I mean, it was quite impressive, quite impressive with all the high rise blocks, skyscrapers, and that sort of thing. And as you got up country, of course, it was very rural, you know, peasants and rice paddies, honey buckets on the corner and all that sort of thing. and Sanwai was not a bad camp, actually. It was about a mile from a village called Fan Ling. And there was one or two sort of small townships that we passed through. One was Tai Po Market. I can still see in my mind's eye the fish laid out on the jetty drying in the sun. But now, of course, we've been to Hong Kong since, my wife and I, and it's now a container port, you know. But yeah.
Now, was this a holding unit?
Yeah. I was going to say. Now this was a holding unit. This was the Middlesex Regiment, who had done their tour of duty in Korea. They were one of the first regiments out there. They'd done their tour of duty.
It's been the first battalion, Middlesex.
The first battalion, Middlesex. Yeah.
And you were attached to them.
And we were attached to them for training purposes. And we did the normal sort of training, sort of intensive training and patrol work and field work.
Let's start with weapons.
Weapons were rifle and LMG. And we were using the Sten guns then as well.
What did you think of the Sten gun?
Oh, not a bad little gun. It was a bit of a novelty, really, you know. After handling a rifle, it was a bit of a novelty. A bit crude, in my opinion, but there we are.
Were you aware of some of the problems of the?
Yeah, it used to jam pretty badly, but I think the ones we had were slightly improved version, and the likelihood of jamming had reduced quite a bit.
What about the sometimes they fired when you weren't expecting them to, as well if you banged them?
Well, yeah.
Were you aware of that?
I was aware of that, yeah, because somebody banged it on the ground and it loaded a cartridge and it fired up in the air, you know, and we were all pretty wary after that because it was a bit of a delicate weapon to play about with.
They weren't very accurate either, were they?
Not really. They spread shot quite a bit, which really in close combat is not a bad thing because you know, you're sharing it out amongst the enemy rather than putting five holes through the same bloke.
So you quite liked it for that?
Yeah, not bad. Yeah, it was good. But I didn't do a great deal of weapons training. Because after about 2 weeks, we got the options to go on these specialist courses, and my brother was a pioneer sergeant in the army, and I opted to go on the assault pioneer course, and this consisted of mines, explosives, booby traps.
Well, let's go through one at a time because there's probably a bit about all of it.
Yeah.
So, which was the first thing that they start with, or which is the one that comes to mind first?
Well, shall we say mine laying? We were taught how to lay mines to a pattern.
Now what do you mean by that? Can you just explain?
Yes, you got a bit of ground, and you get a leader of the group, and you'd lay these laid mines to a pattern so that they could be mapped and documented, so that if and when you got to pick the mines up, you knew more or less where they were, rather than just sow them haphazard all over the place, as has been done in the sort of Far East and causing all these problems. We more or less knew fairly accurately where the mines were actually laid, and you got a leader, and we used to run out a white tape, and you'd walk down this white tape, say six paces, and you put out your arm, and they'd lay a mine twice the length of your arm away. Go down another six paces, and you put out your right arm, and they'd lay a mine a couple of arms lengths away from there. And so on, you'd carry on through the...
And when you say lay a mine, what type of mine?
Well,
how do you...
Yeah, and anti-tank mines, they would be just below the ground, or level with the ground. And then an anti-personnel mine would be this was a mine that was actually in like a metal sleeve, and a ballastite cart, if it was tripped with the tripwire, a ballastite cartridge would fire this thing into the air, which would explode at about 6 foot above the ground. These were placed in the ground. Shall we say, just about out of sight.
So that's first thing, mine laying.
Yeah, mine laying.
What about digging them up again? When you didn't know where they were.
Well,
mine clearance.
Mine clearance was part of the training. One group would probably lay the mines one day, and another group would come and sweep for them the following day. We would have an electrical sweeper, but in the main, a lot of it was done by touch and probing with the bayonet, where you would crawl forward and you would mark your path, and you'd have a roll of white tape strapped to your back, and you would probe a couple of feet each side of your body. See if you could find a mine, and you'd go over it pretty well, and gradually inch forward until you got to the edge of the minefield, and that tape would be secured, and then you'd go on to you'd come back on the next pathway sort of thing.
And what about when you actually found a mine? How would you?
You had some little white triangles, which would open out into like a little four-sided pyramid, and you would lay that over the mine and go on to the next one, and then somebody else would come up, carefully dig it up and retrieve it.
So not one of the assault pioneers?
Oh, yes, most probably.
So tell me about the digging up part then, if that was your job for the
day. Yeah, yeah. Well, obviously, the mines that we were practicing on weren't armed, but you would dig round them and dig underneath them and feel for any hidden springs or booby traps, and then you would lift it carefully out of the hole and lay it on the side so it could be visibly seen and then taken away.
So that's mines. Anything else to do with mines, or?
No, not really. No, I don't think so.
Something else you mentioned, explosives. So
explosives, yeah. We did.
There?
Well, we did a number of explosives. We did a task on a hill in. We were at a battle training school called Sai Kung, which was in the New Territories, which is Saikung, where we were doing this assault pioneer course. The instructors were a Captain Hubbard and Sergeant Schulfer, S-C-H-U-L-F-E-R.
But they were taking the explosives training.
No, they were doing the whole of the assault pioneer course, which, all right.